People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions.
Hello, I'm Chris Nicklin with this week's People of Note. Large parts of our beloved Cape have been laid waste by raging wildfires in recent weeks. From ecologically sensitive areas in the Overberg to Lion's Head above the City Bowl here in Cape Town. Firestorms such as these that devour almost everything in their path have become commonplace in so-called Mediterranean climates like Portugal, Greece and Australia, among others, that share the same mild wet winters and warm dry summers as Cape Town. And words like megafires and firenados are being coined by the media to describe the near apocalyptic scenes. Patrick Ryan is a Cape-based specialist wildland firefighter, and he's this week's guest on People of Note. Hi there, Patrick.
Hi, Chris.
Have you been experiencing a new intensity, a ferocity, if you like, in the kind of fires you're called on to fight that some scientists and environmentalists are ascribing to the mounting effects of global warming?
I've definitely seen an increase in the sort of intensity of fires and the way fires are burning. In the time that I've been involved in wildfire and become and got into it professionally, I've seen a sort of a dramatic increase in fire behavior to the point where a fire, it doesn't seem like there are more fires burning, but when the fires do take off, they really take off quickly and are incredibly aggressive.
Broadly speaking, would you agree that climate change is making conditions more favorable for the sort of wildfires that we are witnessing in places like California, Australia, and indeed here?
I would definitely say so. I mean, I'm not a scientist, but I read and research quite a lot on this topic, and I think we're facing quite a problematic future as we have more and more sort of fires and bigger fires and peat fires releasing a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere. It's going to speed up the climate change and the sort of warming process, and in turn, that's going to increase our sort of ability of the vegetation to burn rapidly and more destructively.
And exactly how is global warming creating the conditions that also conducive to these veritable firestorms?
Well, it's an increased severity of weather. So we're seeing more extreme weather patterns evolving. Mm-hmm. So they're not able to predict exactly how many, you know, so when droughts are going to happen. There's a chance that droughts could become more frequent. We've got an increase in the temperatures. So as every year we get the sort of the warmest or hottest December since whatever time, and it seems to be every year is that is happening.
Mm-hmm. As has been happening in Australia just lately.
Exactly. So with that happening, we've got a hot environment, you've got dry vegetation, and when you have rain, it seems to come down in sort of heavy periods, and then of course you get this warm weather in between that, and that causes a massive amount of growth. So in fact, we're just getting to a point of very fast vegetation growth, and then a warm, dry environment, and you know, especially our climates are designed to burn.
So even when it rains and produces that lush vegetation, it's actually creating fuel for the next big fire that comes along.
It is. Every time we go through several mild fire seasons, as they're called, I get concerned because I know that there's sort of more and more vegetation growth. And I don't think the vegetation management can keep up with what's going on. So we're facing more potential of destructive and large fires occurring.
So in a sense, it's a vicious cycle being compounded by this global warming.
It is, and I think we're a little bit fortunate in that time. Our sort of vegetation environment is more around the fynbos with the alien invasives within it. We don't quite have the massive vegetation load that they have in the States and in Australia, but even in the Mediterranean countries, you can see that there have been some really, really explosive fires occurring in their vegetation, which is quite similar to ours. The same with California, and their vegetation is again quite similar to ours.
And of course, climate change, global warming, call it what you will, has its doubters, opponents even. At the height of the particularly deadly fires in California last year, President Trump blamed the situation on inadequate tree clearing. Did he have a point?
I think in some regards, to be the person sitting on the fence, I think he has a point. I think there has been the America in particular had a policy they brought in the early 20th century, which was to suppress all fires by 10 o'clock the next day. And what this did is it allowed a lot of vegetation to grow up, and you get a massive buildup in forests of dead vegetation. So when a fire does take off, it takes off dramatically quickly. The difference, though, is he was off point with that particular comment in that particular fire. because it was burning in a chaparral before it got into the forests or forested areas. So, you know, clearing the forests, it's more about how we live in the landscape rather than, I think, how we manage the landscape, I think, is almost going to be difficult to do with the budgets we have. So we need to live within that landscape in a sort of safer way.
Mm. So, as you say, President Trump was out of line with that comment. It's not just a question of eradicating trees that might be a problem. It's a much more holistic matter that needs addressing.
I think as humans, we've actually lost touch, especially the Western cultures have lost touch with how fire has been managed. And if you go around the world and you look at the various different people who are indigenous people living in areas, they used to live with fire in the landscape quite well. In fact, they would have a practice of burning quite often and living within that landscape. So they would manage their fuel loading, so which would encourage the right type of growth and the animals to come into an area without there being this build-up of vegetation and then these very destructive fires. In the West, I think we have an aversion to wildfire, and I think where we want to be is an area where the communities and people are kept safe with fire burning around them, but letting the fire burn through the landscape naturally the way it should and just basically managing the areas that need to be managed.
And as you've alluded, global warming is contributing to much longer fire seasons when people like yourself have to maintain a constant vigil. Are we also experiencing this in a pronounced way here in the Western Cape?
Yes, I think the term fire season is now an anathema to all the fire chiefs out there. They don't like the term, and I tend to agree with them. There is no such thing as a fire season anymore. We have a summer and a winter. Both in different areas of the province or the country are dry, and we have fires burning throughout the year. As you saw recently in 2017, of the fires burning in the Southern Cape Coast. This can happen at any time of the year.
But specifically here in the Western Cape, there is an obvious fire season, isn't there, like now?
Yes, there is a fire season around the summer, but it's quite clear that this is now extended. Fires are starting much earlier, sort of the October, September-October time, and we're going through into May with fires as well. So we're seeing a dramatic change in the timeline on that.
Patrick, let's hear your first musical choice on People of Note, please. What do you have?
Well, I've got the track Straight to Hell by The Clash. Felt it was quite appropriate, so we're talking about fire fire suppression and being involved in some of these large fires is definitely something that comes to mind.
Right, let's take a listen to it.
Mama Sam, of you and Mama Sam. Let me tell you about your blood bamboo kin.
It ain't Coca-Cola, it's rice.
Straight to hell, boy.
Go straight to hell, boy.
Go straight to hell, boy.
Go straight to hell, boy.
Oh, Papa Sam, please take me home. Oh, Papa Sam, everybody, they wanna go home. So Mama Sam says, wanna play mind crazed banjo on the druggy drag ragtime USA in Parkland International. Hey, junkie dumb USA, where pro came proves the purest rock man groove and rat poison. The volatile Molotov says, straight to hell. Can you cough it up loud and strong? The immigrants, they wanna sing all night long. It could be anywhere, most likely could be any frontier, any hemisphere. In no man's land, there ain't no asylum. King Solomon, he never lived round here. Straight to hell, boy. Go straight to hell, boy. Go straight to hell, boy. Go straight to hell, boy.
That was the English rock band The Clash with Straight to Hell, the choice of Patrick Ryan, wildland firefighting specialist. Patrick, your professional background was in the cutthroat but hardly physically dangerous world of advertising. What possessed you to swap the sharp suits of an ad agency for the bulky protective gear of a firefighter?
I think it was very much one of those things where you'd say it's fate. I saw a fire burning on the mountain in 2009, and I went up with my camera the next day to take photographs, and I found the scenes of the firefighters coming off the mountain quite evocative. I wanted to take photographs of them and do portraits, so I banked that for a while, and it sat there as a project. And then a couple of years later, I was going through things I really wanted to do, and I felt I wanted to reignite this project. I approached the Volunteer Wildfire Service at the time and said to them, like, I'm very keen to get on the fire line and do portraits. And they told me that if I'm going to do that, I'm going to have to train. It's a dangerous environment. I need to understand the risks and how to protect myself out there. And as I went through the training, I just found an absolute passion for it. Going out to my first fire was like nothing I'd ever thought it would be. Mm. But despite having second thoughts at one point in the fire, by the end of the evening, I realized this is something I really wanted to be involved with. And I just got more and more into it, used my photography to try and raise awareness and understanding of what it is like to be on the fire line as a wildland firefighter. A lot of people think wildland firefighters, you know, of the red trucks and the brigades. But in fact, they're a different group. We often in the yellow shirts and we're up the mountain fighting a fire with hand tools. And I wanted to bring that through to people. So I've been working on a book literally for the last 5 years, which is still in process. And my aim is to get that out there one day.
Yeah, photography is certainly an unusual route to get into firefighting.
It is. I think it was a very kind of self-absorbed route. But when I got in there, I realized what wildfire was all about and what sort of the term integrated fire management had around it. And hopefully with, I sort of felt with my skill sets from the advertising world and design and marketing, I could come in and try and use those to raise awareness, not just about fighting fire, but everything that goes around it and the things which is probably more important of what you can do to prevent that and the people who are involved in it.
In fact, when I first met you a few years back at what's called a controlled burn in the Boerland, you were pointing a camera at the fire rather than a hose pipe.
Yes, yeah, I let the rest of our crew get on the hose, but I also find that it's important to study fire. The more you're out there and you're able to watch that fire behavior, you start finding its voice. It sounds a bit strange, but you're looking for that those tiny little indicators that the fire behavior is changing. And I'm very focused on safety these days. And so the more you understand fire, the more you observe it, the more you can study it, the more you know about it.
I was going to ask you, what compels you to document fire scenes in this way?
I think there's, well, the obvious thing is there's a drama in there that is you're not going to find in other areas of life. And then coming from the sort of very crafted, sort of predicted world of advertising and doing advertising shoots where everything is geared towards trying to sell a product or trying to get people to sort of sucker into to buying a product, going into the wildfire environment was almost becoming like a documentary photographer. I had to react to what was going on. I had seconds, if that, to capture certain images before I had to get back into fighting fire. And then you've got this incredibly epic scene around you that as an artist I just want to capture and convey to people.
But visually, isn't one fire much like another? I suppose what I'm asking is, how's it possible to keep spotting images on the fire line that show something new, something different?
Every fire is different. That's something I've learned. I never stop learning as a firefighter in every fire I go to, and invariably there's just always different images. It's some small moment. It's something you see in a firefighter as he turns his head away and he's got ash in his eye, and there's a particular way the light catches that, and you just a moment you're not going to get in any other way. Or you're on top of a mountain hiking 7 kilometers to get back to your pickup point, desolate landscape around you and the sun going down through clouds, and it's just this sort of almost like a movie scene. And you capture that, and you're never going to have that moment or that time again to capture that. And when you go to the next fire, there'll be something different. So it's incredibly stimulating. I love going through the images.
So we'll get to see these photographs when you eventually publish that book you were talking
about. I'm putting previews out through Instagram quite a bit. But yes, I'm hoping to get the book out within the next year.
Firefighting by its very nature is reactive, but the main thrust of your work, as I understand, Patrick, is actually preemptive. You advise people on ways to prevent their properties going up in flames. Exactly what does this involve?
It's very much tied into the wildfire ready hashtag and concept that we're driving at the moment, and this is getting people to understand that you can live in the environment with fire, and you can exist with wildfire going on around you if you've put the right preventative measures in. So that's making sure that your home, your small holding, or your farm is able to have a fire burn around it, or not have those embers land on your home or in your garden and ignite the home or garden. So you need to sort of make your home, take away all the vulnerabilities in your home to embers getting into a home. And it's very much, it's embers that cause most of the homes to burn.
Who do you typically consult then?
It was Big Wine Farms out in the Stellenbosch, Overberg area. And we're trying very hard to get individual homeowners and communities in particular to start understanding what they can do as very basic things to make themselves safe. And as we've seen the fire burning down a few years ago into Simonstown, through Betty's Bay, various other areas, these communities are not safe from wildfire, especially with the conditions the way they are. So if they can speak to someone and get the right advice on just very basic measures that they can put in, then they can make their community a lot safer. And when a wildfire burns through, the idea is instead of everyone evacuating and having homes burning, you'd rather have people able to stay in a safe area and then go back and put out the small fires and allow the fire to burn around the community.
Obviously, it's not possible to completely fireproof your property, so I suppose it's more about reducing or limiting the risks of fire hazards.
It's completely that. It's all about reducing the risks and going through the processes. Understanding that if you're living near gums or pines, you're going to constantly have needles and bits of bark in your gutters, and those, it just takes one ember. Also wetting down your garden, making sure that you don't have a vegetation build up around your home. I saw a very successful photograph from near Pringle Bay where a homeowner had planted a lot of sour fig, and milkweeds around their home and made sure that you know, it wasn't very sort of volatile plants.
Mm.
And the fire actually burnt around that property. And this is what you want to encourage people is, it's not just putting a firebreak in, it's making sure that when an ember lands in your garden or in the community, that there's nothing there for it to really ignite.
So something as simple and cost-effective as wild figs?
Yeah, completely. It's called the home ignition zone, and we really want people to focus on that and reducing the risk in the home ignition zone.
Mm. I'd like to get on to specific tips for protecting your property against fires that get out of control. But let's take another music break, Patrick. What's your second choice?
Well, I used to play the trumpet when I was at school, and I've always loved that sound. So it's Chet Baker with My Funny Valentine.
My funny valentine, sweet comic valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak? When you open it to speak, are you smart? But don't change your hair for me. If you care for me, stay, little Valentine, stay. Each day is Valentine's Day.
The American jazz trumpeter and vocalist Chet Baker with Funny Valentine, the choice of Patrick Ryan, specialist wildland firefighter, who's this week's guest on People of Note. So Patrick, for people who live in the so-called wildland-urban interface, you mentioned Simonstown a short while ago, whose properties are most vulnerable to the kind of runaway fires we've been talking about, what are the key measures they should take to safeguard life and property?
Well, you need to reduce your vegetation buildup around the home. And there's an area in the sort of the first 1 to 3 meters, and we call it the red zone, and that's where you really want to make sure you have really good vegetation management. And then you move out from there to about 10 meters, and you want to get away, sort of take out the ability for fire to come off the mountain and literally move like water through your property, so from plant to plant to plant to the home, which it can do, and we call those fire corridors. So you want to try and break those up. It's good to have a fire break. I think there's a misunderstanding that fire breaks will stop fires. The fire break won't stop a fire.
Certainly when there's a howling southeaster.
Completely. It's there to more there to allow fire services to get in and try and fight the fire in a safe area. So you have to understand that the fire can very easily come down off the mountain through the embers that are flying in the air and landing and reigniting. As soon as a home catches fire in that wildland urban interface, that again is fuel, and that adds to it. And once one home starts burning, the chances of other homes nearby burning dramatically increase. I think it jumps up by sort of 50% exponentially. So if you've got gaps in your roof, if you've got air vents that aren't covered, embers can get into the roof space. It's very, very dry and full of dust in the roof space, and it can ignite in there very quickly. Once a roof catches fire, a house can go in minutes. And we saw this in Knysna, people talking about houses going up in 5 minutes. Again, certain plants and trees are terrible to have around your home. Palms are really terrible for catching embers and then throwing more embers, and of course those fly across the urban interface. So it's all about getting the right advice, but there are basics you can do with closing up your any areas that can allow embers to get into a home. If you can, go for double glazing rather than single glazing glass. If you get a lot of heat coming off a fire, it'll break a window, and then once that happens, the fire, you know, the heat gets into the room, or the curtains ignite, embers get into the home.
Interesting that you place so much emphasis on the embers, and I was reading the other day about so-called ember showers, the small pieces of burning matter carried by the wind, which can start fires many kilometers away.
Completely. I mean, there's some, we heard stories of pine cones flying sort of hundreds of meters in Nyasner. The bark off.
Really, that far?
Completely. Yeah. And there's a bark off particular gum trees, which is, it's sort of like a strip bark that comes off, and that's been known to travel kilometers and alight. It gets up into the sort of upper atmosphere and then falls back down again, and that keeps burning and smoldering. Once it drops down with the wind, it ignites and it causes a spot fire, we call it. One of the best things you can do is just find information, speak to the right person about what you need to do around your home or as a community to reduce that risk.
But possibly one of the most useful tips I think you've mentioned here is fireproofing your property against those embers that find their ways into the chinks in your building.
Completely. There was there's a fire scientist in America called Dr. Jack Cohen, and he went and did a study on loss of homes in California, and he was quite amazed to find this wave of destruction through neighborhoods. And when he studied it, he realized that the trees weren't burnt, the homes were burnt. So it wasn't a wave of fire moving through the neighborhood. And we saw this with Nyasner. It was basically a fire reaching that sort of urban edge, but the embers landing into gardens that were full of dry vegetation, or piles of wood next to homes, outdoor furniture that is combustible, and these ignite, and those throw more embers, or they ignite and they cause a home to ignite, and that then, if the home is less than 30 meters from another home, those homes from the radiant heat alone will ignite each other, and then it just starts a chain reaction.
And Patrick, as the fire advances on your home, heaven forbid, are there any last minute things you can do while you're sort of chaotically trying to pack your mementos and what have you, assuming if you have the time?
Most definitely. You want to wet down as much as possible all the vegetation around your home. Close all your doors and windows. Take down your curtains, because those can ignite through radiant heat. You want to wet down your roof. Fill your gutters with water. What I do is, I've got a plan at my house. I would block the gutter, the downpipes. Fill the gutters with water so nothing can get in there. Make sure you've got your animals. Make sure you've got your passport and everything. And then listen for the emergency services about evacuations and follow what they say. As soon as the fire's burnt through the area, try and find out how soon you can get back to your home by speaking to emergency services, so you can go and stop the small fires. We found that when we did our report on the Nyasner fires, of houses burning days afterwards, where little embers had landed and were burning sort of hours or days later, and then that would cause a home to ignite. And if someone, and the few times we had people who had gone back, they'd put those fires out. So it's a very difficult situation, because you don't want people going back into a dangerous area. That's why it has to go under the command of the fire. But if you prep your home properly, if you've got the right measures in place, you should be able to leave your home and then come back to it.
You mention evacuation, and you hear stories of people stubbornly remaining in their properties once a general evacuation of the population has taken place. Presumably that's just plain reckless.
It is reckless. I think if there's an evacuation order in place, you need to leave. Get your precious possessions and leave. By staying, what you're doing is you're actually endangering the fire services. They're going to worry about you being there. They're probably going to try and get you out of there. They might be then detained from dealing with something else. And you're a distraction. And as soon as there's a distraction, that's dangerous.
Have you come across people doggedly refusing to leave?
I haven't personally, but I've heard stories of people literally having to be sort of dragged out of homes all too often.
As the population in Cape Town continues to swell, you see people building houses at even higher elevations on the mountain, directly in the so-called wildland-urban interface. Should this be discouraged in your view?
I think discourage is difficult. There's always going to be expansion. I think that town planners need to understand how to allow building in those environments. One of the things I was quite surprised to see that after Nyasner was people being building their homes back again in the same way, with the same materials, with the same vegetation starting to build up. And that, you know, when you keep repeating the same thing again with hoping for a different outcome, it's insanity. So I do think with the right measures in place, you can build in the environment. And the reason we are seeing this loss is we are putting ourselves into an environment that will burn naturally, and it's not going to stop. It's going to keep happening. But if we understand how to build in that environment properly, then we can really make a difference.
One of my brothers who lives in Ojai in Southern California, which was pretty much at the epicenter of one of the U.S.'s most devastating wildfires in late 2017, says property owners in areas most vulnerable to fires are resorting to something called biomimicry. For example, trees in fire-prone areas have evolved to grow thick bark that serves as armor against the heat of fires. Can this concept be used in buildings in any way?
I think it can. They've done a lot of tests in Australia on and they've actually brought in a lot of sort of standards that if you're going to build in that environment, you have to build with certain materials. You have to clear vegetation out to a certain area. You need to have a wildfire bunker that you would go down into to stay safe. So I think definitely we've lost touch in so many ways with nature and how nature survives. I think if we do look at nature and how things naturally survive in that environment, and we could actually learn a lot, and not just in wildfire, I think in many areas of life.
Are there any materials that are commercially available now that kind of replicate what we're talking about?
I'm not too sure. I mean, I've been looking recently into the different building materials in South Africa, and I think we're fairly limited. There's a lot more work going on in Australia and America in particular with the materials that are sort of, say, fire resistant.
Yeah.
What I do know is it was quite interesting is there was a building, a wooden structure during the Knysna fire that didn't burn in a very, very hot part of the fire, although it did have the vegetation cleared around it, and it had been treated with boron, which was quite interesting. But again, you know, this is a study that needs to be done. I think we need to look at the materials that we need to use, and it's also modern building techniques. The modern structures are far less vulnerable to wildfires. See, in a state in Knysna, we flew over with a helicopter documenting that whole scene. There's one estate that stood out in particular. It was a new building, new construction, new homes, and it hadn't had the vegetation build up, and the fire literally moved around it and torching houses all around it. There were older construction.
Time for some more music, Patrick. What's your third choice?
It's a band I've recently come across called The War on Drugs, and I particularly like their sound. It reminds me of a kind of a resurgence of Roxy music with a twist of something else like Arcade Fire, and their song is Under the Pressure.
Thank you.
The American indie rock band, The War on Drugs, with Under Pressure, chosen by our People of Note guest, Patrick Ryan. Patrick, when you watch these great fires from a distance, like the one in Betty's Bay and Royals, you wonder whether it's ever possible to put them out. What strategies are used by firefighting teams in these seemingly hopeless situations, from a layperson's perspective at least?
Right, there's two terms I'm going to use, and they are sort of, hopefully they apply to the layman. There's indirect and direct, and these are the two forms of dealing with fires.
Okay, we're not going to get too technical.
No. Direct literally means on the fire line, fighting it, you know, with hand tools, creating fire breaks, or you know, control lines, we call them, and hitting them with hoses. And then there's indirect, when a fire is very big, you can pull away from a fire, and then you use fire to fight fire, by burning off roads or existing fire breaks. And so you'll burn the vegetation out, or the fuel that the fire will consume. So you take away that intensity of a fire coming in towards you by burning out, and the two fires literally suck towards each other and then negate that energy.
But both sound like a lot of work when you have a huge fire bearing down on you. There must be surely little time to play with.
No, I think that's one of the things where I take my hat off to the incident commanders and fire chiefs out there, having to make these decisions very quickly about what strategy and tactics to put in place to try and keep the properties safe. And again, I'm going to push the point of, the more as communities and homeowners we make sure our homes are sort of safer and less fire prone, the less they're going to have to worry about that, and the more they can actually manage the fire.
There must be occasions when you think you're just fighting a losing battle.
Quite often. I mean, a fire is an incredibly powerful, difficult force of nature to try and control. And that's why I like the term manage rather than fight fires. You're going to lose lines. The fire's going to jump past you. You're going to have to pull out. You've got embers and smoke in your face and heat. It's really not easy. So the more you can go in there and try and have a moment to decide exactly how to take on that fire line in the best way possible, better, as to the tactics you're going to employ.
The obvious heroes of these kind of conflagrations are obviously the firefighters themselves, many of whom are volunteers. How much does it play on your mind that you're constantly putting yourself in a life-threatening situation whenever you take on these fires?
I actually see the situation as safer than driving.
Really?
We train very hard, and the volunteers train very hard, and when we had our crew, you train very hard, and we go through a lot of strategic thinking and tactical thinking and understanding fire behavior. There's also a lot of operating procedures, and there's a thing called standard orders and watch out situations that we remind people about and go through in training every time you're on a standby. So when you go out there, you're aware, you've got a situation, a heightened situation awareness, you're aware of what's happening, you're watching the fire behavior, you understand things are going to change, and you're looking for, you know something.
Even with unpredictable winds.
You know it's unpredictable, so you go out understanding it's unpredictable and preparing for that. So you have your plan A, plan B, plan C. So in that regard, you're not out there on a road with, you know, sort of an unpredictable driver. You've got a fire burning in a way that you've seen it burning already, so you understand that, yes, it's making runs or there are firewalls happening. This means that we can't do plan A, so we're going to have to pull back and do plan B. So I often think it's a lot safer. Problem comes in when you have a miscommunication or you don't have proper command structure in place, and then you have chaos, and when you have that, then you have serious issues.
Have you ever found yourself in a particularly tricky situation?
Several times. Gone into a situation understanding that this could change very quickly. What do I do is we make sure you have something called an escape route to a safety zone, and you always have that in place. So if something goes wrong, I know that I've got 2 minutes to get to a certain spot where I'll be safe. If it goes wrong and I can't go back that way, I've got my other option to go a different route. Found ourselves in situations before where we had to hunker down in the burnt area on top of a mountain for an entire night and watch a sort of ember storm fly over our heads for the entire night. There was nothing we could do. But we were safe, and when we went into that situation, we understood if things happened, we would have this safe place to go to.
Do you ever think this is one close shave too many, time to bail out of this business?
No, I...
That's very encouraging.
I haven't had that. Again, I try very hard to be... to have the sort of higher situational awareness I can and try and approach it in the safest way possible, and then go for it with all guns blazing.
But Patrick, nonetheless, you often hear about firefighters losing their lives while battling fires. How does this typically happen?
I think it's that human factor. Unfortunately, as humans, we make mistakes. We don't always see everything we should see. We don't have all the training we need, or we misinterpret a situation. And unfortunately, that happens, and that's the risk that is there in firefighting. I think the better the training is, the less chance of that happening.
I was at the Hiermalenada fire in mid-January, and I met a volunteer fire crew leader who said he'd been fighting fires every day since before Christmas. That must take an enormous toll on one's health.
I think it does. You know, just being in that environment is tough. The heat is really not good for you. It can lead to blood clots if you're in front of extreme heat for extended periods.
What kind of temperatures, Patrick?
Oh, a wildfire has been documented burning about 1,200 degrees Celsius, at times slightly hotter. The temperatures that the guys face on the ground is normally between the 300, 500 degrees, and obviously that dissipates as it's coming off the ground towards you. But these are extreme temperatures, and they have a massive toll and effect on the body, and then the smoke itself is, again, toxic. So you have to make sure you try and get out of that environment as often as possible, refresh your lungs, back in again. If you're in it too long, it can have all sorts of detrimental effects on your body and your health.
I read that firefighters can lose about 6 kilograms of water weight during a shift, and they're thirsty all the time because they're just sweating so much.
Completely. We actually, if you go on the fire line as a ground crew firefighter, you carry a minimum of 5 or 6 liters with you, and you'll go through that within the first couple of hours of a large fire or on a hot day quite easily. And then you're going to need to be replenished. I've been on fires where I've gone through 12 liters in one day.
Mm-hmm. And presumably that's why the call always goes out to the public when there's a big fire. Please donate fresh drinking water as much as possible.
Completely. I mean, I think that's one of the main things is getting water and getting sort of electrolytes to firefighters is very important.
And Paul, how easy is it to become a volunteer firefighter? What are the qualities that organizations that are manned by, or I should say staffed by, volunteer firefighters?
Volunteers, you need to go to a reputable organization, somebody who has good policies and procedures.
Something like Working on Fire?
Well, the Working on Fire is actually an extended public works program. Right. So they're paid for by government, and they paid a stipend. That program is run by, is overseen by a management company. So that's not really a volunteer program. Mm-hmm. That's actually just a poverty alleviation project. The volunteers are more like the volunteer wildfire services or the Overberg volunteers. And they recruit people and they go through very stringent, especially the volunteer wildfire services, go through very stringent training procedures. You then have to pass tests to be able to get out there on the fire line. You have to pass a physical test and you have to pass a knowledge test, understanding what the fire behavior can do and what you need to do on a fire line. So if you pass that, you can go out there, and then every year this is repeated. So you have to maintain your fitness and your health, and you have to make sure your knowledge and skills are up to date.
Patrick, time for your fourth and final track, please. What is it?
It's Roxy Music, More Than This.
I notice you've had a particular preference for rock music. 3 out of 4 have been there.
It's very much part of my soul. I mean, I love classical. I played some classical music when I was younger, but I just felt that these kind of link to more of the conversation today.
Yeah.
That was the English rock band Roxy Music with More Than This. Patrick, is it ever possible to give an accurate view on how soon an area destroyed by a wildfire will be able to recover?
It's not really my area of expertise, but I would think you can get a pretty good idea. If the right measures are put in place, you've got to worry about things like landslides and areas where the slopes lost all its vegetation. And I think the main thing to get on top of is making sure that the indigenous vegetation has a chance to recover. As soon as an area is burnt out, what we're finding is there's a massive increase in the alien invasive vegetation.
After fires here in the Western Cape, you often hear people saying, but the fynbos needs to be burned every so often. That's not strictly true, is it?
No, if it burns too often, we will lose species. And I think we are seeing that happen. And as soon as those species are gone, the other species, the alien invasive species move in, or the grasses move in and take over. Mm. And as soon as the grasses move in, it'll burn a lot quicker and more often. And then if the fynbos doesn't get a chance to sort of get to its mature state, we will lose those.
Can I ask you about the water that is bucketed over fynbos by the fire helicopters? Is seawater ever used, and is this potentially damaging?
The seawater is used, and there's no problem with fynbos in the coastal regions. It's used to that salt air, so there's no problem using salt water on that.
As wildfires become an increasing challenge, is there new technology in the offing of how to best overcome them?
There's always going to be, I think, new technology. What we're seeing in America is you bringing in bigger aerial resources, so bigger planes, bigger helicopters, more water, and it's actually not making a difference. So while there is possibly, I think we need to look at more the technology that can help keep homes safe, so particular foams that a homeowner can spray onto their home and then move away and leave it and make sure it won't burn. We need to focus on actually prevention and making sure that we have safe environments or wildfire resilient environments to live in.
Can wildfires be predicted like the weather, so that we're not always caught off guard by a sudden flare-up, so that people like yourself don't have to be on constant standby at this time of year?
I think that would be a great paper for a climatologist. I think you can predict to a certain degree. You know the felt age, you've got the number of fires that happen in an area. Certain areas are more prone, and normally because there's people in the landscape. And if you look at the weather patterns, you can tell that there could be fires. But as to a fire being in a particular area, I think that's just too hard, because with the human factor comes into play, and with that, it's completely unpredictable.
In the meantime, it's back to the fire watch, Patrick, and thank you very much for being a guest on People of Note.
Thanks very much, Chris.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
Peter Turin and Kickstart invite you to take a musical journey into a world where nothing is as it seems. From the 30th of January to the 2nd of March, revel in Stephen Sondheim's sublime musical, Into the Woods, starring Kate Normington, Earl Gregory, Ashley Harvey, and a star-studded cast at Theatre on the Bay. Go into the woods where witches can be right, giants can be good. You decide what's right, you decide what's good. Into the Woods, only at Theatre on the Bay from January the 30th.